There's a particular parable or proverb is the word that really is going to speak volumes for us this morning as we consider that scripture reading from Ephesians chapter 2 and other portions of the Bible. This proverb goes, "Knitting is the perfect metaphor for life. You might spend months knitting something, but you could probably unravel the whole thing in less than an hour." King David, he exclaimed long ago, "You formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. Praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well." This, King David said in Psalms 139, verses 13 and 14. And in Colossians, Paul makes known how he's poured himself into his ministry, ensuring that the church, as he says, may be encouraged, being knit together in love. Colossians 2, verses 1 to 2. And one of the realities of our faith and our walk is that as God's design and work within us catches a snag, is tugged on, or for whatever reason begins to unravel, well then God's design and work of a larger scope and scale will also come to suffer. It's not long before a snag within us plays out on a grander stage. And as we know, it takes much more time, effort, fear and wonder even, to knit something together than it does to unravel it. Whether we're talking about our lives and faith or the more complex picture of the vitality of the church. Thus, as last week, Valentine's Day, leads us into Family Day long weekend, so too does the subject of love bring us to the consideration of the church. Love, we've seen last week, if you were here, is a lens. And as God's love becomes a visible power in our lives, giving witness to the gospel and through it the unseen God, as we've seen in 1 John chapter 4, love also becomes a bond. Just as love is a lens through which to see and show forth God, love, it's also the sinew and the ligament that binds the church together for all its diversity in unity. Hence, God's love, it seeks and it intends to accomplish a familial goal, the love of God that begets itself within us. Well, it goes beyond us because it knits together one to another people in love. And if things went as smoothly as that, we wouldn't have a sermon today, much less certain spans of scriptures. I mean, think about it. Just how does family happen? In a sense, we should know how family can happen. Because family, it can happen in ways that it should never happen. If you take a look at the Latin language, the Romans, they absolutely knew this fact. They had a lot of words to describe the unraveling of family. A few of them are parricide, which means the murders of one's parent. Fratricide, the murder of a sibling. Filicide or policide, the murder of your own child. And they had a handful of other terms to describe these kinds of realities. And these kind of things, they actually run rampant throughout history. They abound in the histories of royalty, the wealthy, and the powerful especially. But before our trail of labels for this kind of familial failure, before these rose to these kind of lofty heights, it all began at the grassroots level. Cain and Abel. We can say with ease that they were signposts of a grim syndrome. The first murder happened within the first family, between the first pair of human brothers. Family has always been susceptible to unravel in horrid ways because its most basic unit, people, have always had this propensity ever since we fell into sin. And you know, it might be easiest to say that hatred, maybe it's hatred that's the ailment that turns our love cold and frays the fabric of our relationships. But consider what Paul goes on to say in his letter to the Colossians. Next, oh yeah, you're there, thank you. Summarily, what Paul's doing, he's swaying this group in Colossae of Gentile believers. He's trying to persuade them to hold to Christ, while at the same time he's swatting away the demands of some Jewish believers who were actually diminishing Christ. And Paul does this in Colossians chapter 2, verses 18 and 19, when he exposes those who are flanking the Gentile believers. And he says in his own words that they are puffed up without reason by their sensuous mind and not holding fast to the head from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with the growth that is from God. Puffed up, moreover, without reason, being sensuously minded, not holding fast to Christ. That sounds a lot like Cain, doesn't it? If you know the story, Cain, he was lackadaisical in his worship. Yet at the same time, he certainly thought he was due God's favor for some reason. But the favor fell on his younger, more reverent brother. You know, the younger one who doesn't have the birthright. And so Cain, as we see it unfold back in Genesis, he was capable of turning worship, into an arena of self-promotion and self-interest, because that was what was in his heart. We have the same capability. We are just as susceptible today for the same reasons. What's in our heart? Paul and God through him spells out how joints, ligaments, and the whole body comes undone and thrusts itself into pain and Cain-like barbarism. Essentially what he's saying is that the great subversion of our love is indeed the perversion of our own hearts, and it's made all too easy by our pride. It should go without saying that the sinful perversion of our will, that is not suitable for the persuasion of our walk. And so today, as much as we need to be knit together in love, we also need all these other aspects. We need a growth that is from God, and we need the grace that indeed would see us hold fast to the head who is Christ, so that as we grow together in love, our worship would grow truer and purer. Therefore, this morning, what I want to do is I want to confront us with the truth of how family must happen. And how indeed the term church, how that needs to become a byword for family. Especially as family can unravel contrary to God's ideal. And so we're going to turn once more to Ephesians chapter 2, to another and to a quite similar Pauline passage. We're going to be making use of this knitting imagery that we find in Colossians and elsewhere as we approach this passage. And we're going to dovetail all of that knitting business back in at the end. But do keep that language and imagery in mind as we turn to Ephesians. We've just heard it read aloud, but please allow me to recite it once more in order to further anchor us this morning. Once more, Paul says of Jesus, "For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. And he came and preached peace to you who were far off, and peace to those who were near." I'm going to leave it off there since we've just read this passage. Now what Christ has become for us, that is determinative of what shall become of us. Throughout this passage in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul says that Christ is our peace. He makes peace, and he's preached peace. And through this peace, what has he done? He's broken down the dividing wall of hostility And for good measure, Jesus has killed hostility, that we might be joined together to grow in the Lord. But five words into this translation of the passage, there's one big word that brings to mind our little proverb from earlier about knitting and the expediency of its undoing. And that word is our. O-U-R, our. Peace, it's fine, isn't it? Until you start thinking of our peace. Peace, it's a lot lovelier to think about and strive after when peace is private, rather than when its ownership is pluralized. Because who exactly is Paul casting this net of our over? Well, he's casting this word over those between whom there was a storied history of hostility, to say the least. There was even a literal physical dividing wall that entrenched this hostility. See, within the Temple of Jerusalem, there was a dividing wall set between the temple and the outer Gentile courts. And inscribed on this wall, according to one translation, were the words, "No one of another nation to enter within the fence and enclosure around the temple. And whoever is caught will have himself to blame, that his death ensues." Next slide, please. There's actually an image there of a part of this mount warning sign that has been recovered with that inscription on it. And so one commentator actually quips, "It's strangely significant that Paul was finally arrested and condemned by the Jews in Jerusalem on the basis of a false accusation that he took an Ephesian, Trophimus, beyond this barrier," in Acts chapter 21, verses 29 to 30. Between the Jew and the Gentile, over and against a barrier whose breach brought condemnation and death, over and against all of that, Christ has become peace. As Paul says, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the hostile two. See, Christ preached his peace to those near and to those far off. To the Jew who had the scriptures, the commands heaped upon commands, we even further had the bloodlines, access to this temple that they closed off to the other nations, and presumably, through it all, better access to God. But the very same peace Christ preached to the Gentiles who had none of this. As Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, "Do not think that I have come to abolish law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Yet in fulfilling the moral law through his life, the ceremonial law through his death, if we want to reckon that God's law is a wall between Jew and Gentile, well, then we're going to have to imagine that this wall is lying flat on its face. Because the demands of the law were not dismissed. They were met in Jesus on the account of those who would truly hold fast to him. It really is better, actually, not to reckon God's commands as a wall, dilapidated or not, but instead to look upon Christ, who stands tall as our righteousness, whether you are near or far off. Now that said, I can be a little empathetic here, can't I? It sounds like a tough pill to swallow to me, at least. If you are near, if you spent a millennium plus clutching these merits tightly, hoping to cash them in, wrapping and warping your sense of identity around your own righteousness, I can actually empathize with certain first century Jews, especially as a 21st century Christian, because we now have a couple thousand years to our names as Christians. And looking at our history, we should know and be aware that it's not difficult at all to get puffed up without reason. It's not difficult to adopt a sensuous mind. It's not hard to put up walls, to stave off outsiders, or even to divide worship, you know, into our little bit here and those peoples who can go over there, just, don't put us together. It's not hard to substitute our peace with my peace. It's not hard to coast, to think we're due what should be ours, to hold less and less tightly to Christ. But what is hard is to recognize Cain when we wake up one day and maybe see him in our mirror. So I don't know where you're at this morning, whether you need one or not. This is our wake-up call as the church. At the very least, this is a sobering reminder of the urgency that is inherent in the bidding and the calling of the gospel to pursue Christ and to be given to the rickers of God-honoring love. Next slide, please. Thank you. So those who were indeed far off, they're drawn near. And the stranger and alien, they're made kith and kin. As Paul says here, what Christ has done in the flesh and through his cross, it's huge. Christ's cross, it brings atonement, and through it, peace between us, humankind, and God. But also, perhaps what we often overlook, Christ's atoning work establishes peace and love amongst ourselves. Vertically, horizontally, the peace that the gospel projects, all of it, every single bit has been bought with Christ's blood. And be sure of this, that this tremendous price, which we've reflected on in communion, it was paid in full. This point is essential. The vertical or Godward direction of our faith and the horizontal plane of our love for one another, they're inseparable from one another. As one theologian puts it, believers cannot exist apart from Christ. And Christ does not exist apart from his body, the church. The church, it's not a hydra. The church has one head, who is Christ. And Christ has one body. So, ask Paul about just how serious the imagery of knitting is, of God bringing together two estranged and seething entities with each other's blood on their very hands, that they might be enjoined together, that they might grow together, that they might together bear God's image as one, worship him. The peace that Christ has become for us is determinative of what shall become of us. The temple God makes of us, using Paul's imagery, has no dividing wall. Not materially in our infrastructure, and more to the point, not in our hearts. No dividing wall. So what then of our practice? Again, I don't think we'd have this exhortation in store if things played out seamlessly. That's not the biblical expectation. Nevertheless, these truths are intended to be applied to our lives. And in fact, just around the corner here in these scriptures in Ephesians, we're showing that the peace of the gospel must actually become a matter of action in our lives. Next slide, please. And it's in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 1 to 4, where Paul begins to get practical. So let's turn there right now. Paul writes in Ephesians 4, beginning at verse 1. I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the spirits in the bond of peace. There is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. So our peace, Paul says to the church, it implots your call. If we count ourselves under the umbrella of our, then there's a summons that we need to heed. We have a call that comes with a hope. Hope is great. And also, let us not forget a walk that corresponds to this call. And so out of the ashes of the dividing wall laid low, Christ's body, you and I included, today, emerges. And Paul spells out here how we proceed, because this is what it takes to proceed as the church. Firstly, we proceed in humility. And this is a funny one because the first step here in this list of our walk, it's truly triumphant in God's eyes, but in our world's eyes, walking in humility, it looks like we've just stumbled out of the gate and maybe bumped our head on the door on the way down there. One commentator notes, to the Greeks, humility was not a virtue. To them, as indeed to most non-Christian people in any generation, the concept of the fullness of life left no room for humility. In Christ, lowliness became a virtue. His life and death were service and sacrifice without thought of reputation. Service and sacrifice. Those footsteps first and foremost belonged to Christ. And as he calls us to follow him, to hold fast to him, he bids us to grow in this kind of humility. This is what he calls us to. And, you know, if this kind of humility, if it happens not to get you very far in the world, then good, because we're not following or racing them. Secondly, the second aspect of our walk is gentleness. Behind this word is the meaning of meekness or submissiveness. Now, another scholar, he said this of this kind of gentleness. He says, meekness is the spirit of one who is absorbed in seeking some worthy goal for the common good, so absorbed that he refuses to be deflected from it by slights, injuries, or insults directed at himself personally, or indeed by personal considerations of any kind. So, gentleness, we're still very much speaking the language of service and sacrifice. Even though Christ has torn down the dividing wall, I mean, can we be honest? Doesn't it still feel sometimes like we're banging our head against it? You know, I'll confess to you this morning, sometimes I find it difficult, actually, to convince myself that the reality that these verses are speaking of, that it's actually such a worthy goal. I have my days, you know. After all, it's other Christians, for me at least, who get me just steaming more than anybody else. There was one songwriter, he penned the lyric, "Hurt me once, I let it be. Hurt me twice, you're dead to me. Three times makes you family." Perhaps the challenge of committing to the good of love, the good of love and unity through Christ. Perhaps the challenge is to actually to see the good in the common. It's sticking to the script, to God's call to be his body, knit in love and bound by peace, knowing that despite the wounds we endure throughout the process, such as injuries to our pride, our reputation, and even the beard pulling and pugilism reported throughout church history among church leaders, you know, through it all, the challenge is to see that God is at work, that his work is worth it all. It's worth unclenching our fists. It's worth stilling our tongues. It's worth letting things go instead of just holding on and accumulating all kinds of anger and hatred and disdain for one another. Church and the peace and love thereof, it has to be worth being gentle in spite of it all. That's our challenge, and more importantly, that is part of our call. Now, thirdly, comes the quite complementary virtue of patience. You know, the thing that you get advised by wise people never to pray for because then you get opportunities. I actually prayed for it last week, and I'm doing all right so far, so I'll let you know how I am next week. Now, in the sense of the word here, what is meant is slowness in angering. But slowness in avenging wrong or retaliating when hurt by another. And in this sense, this word is used of God's patience with humanity, and it forms the corresponding and consequent quality that the Christian should know towards others. Again, that's what another scholar has said. And now it's at this point, you know, when I was studying this passage, I'm like, oh no. Because more and more, these virtues, yes, they spell out a beautiful ideal to aspire to. But at the same time, you can see this creeping realism rearing its head. Humility, gentleness, and now patience. Those are not the things you give a lot of attention to. Those are not the things that someone exerts this kind of effort to instill in someone, you know, just because, just for the good of it. We're in store for hurt, for scrapes, scars, and the like. That's the reality of family and being knit together in love. But once more, it's God's patience, no less Christ's patience, that patterns our own. It's a beautiful observation to take note of that none of us here this morning are a splat on the pavement. None of us are a smoking heap that was zapped by a divine thunderbolt. Because God is patient. Patience, the behavior of relenting, of forgiving, of burying hatchets, of turning the other cheek, of relinquishing our right and our desire to retaliate. That's what we're called to walk in as we come to belong to one another. And now fourthly and finally comes forbearance. That is the virtue of bearing with one another in love. Forbearance has been defined as the practical outworking of long-suffering. It involves bearing with one another's weaknesses, not ceasing to love one's neighbors or friends because of those faults in them which perhaps offend or displease us. We're funny little creatures, aren't we? You know, our brains, they can do laps. They can do all kinds of gymnastics, all sorts of hard, strenuous work to hide our own faults from ourselves. Yet, it's so easy and natural to tally up and to fixate on the faults that we find in others. And all too easily, we can go and talk about these faults that we find to everyone but the one that we're talking about. Of course, that's gossip. That's what the Bible calls abominable. But it's so easy to start piling up the rubble of the dividing wall, piece by piece, brick by brick, slowly propping up the corpse of hostility. And if that were acceptable, then we ourselves could never be acceptable. Because we all have our own faults and weaknesses that offend and displease others, yeah, of course, but even more than anything else, that offends God. On a daily basis, we cannot do, we cannot even be this whole church thing without forbearance. We would never know God's love and grace without His forbearance with us. We're called to offer the same grace that He gives us to one another as well. And so we skimmed this over. Oh, we didn't even skim it. We didn't touch this. But in between all this theology and now in chapter 4, this practice that's laid before us that we're called to, in chapter 3 of Ephesians, Paul has this prayer, and part of it is that the church, which includes you and I today, that it would be, in his words, rooted and grounded in love. Rooted and grounded in love. Just as we are urged in Colossians chapter 2 to be knit together in love. And it's on the heels of this prayer that comes all this prompting, this urging to walk in humility, gentleness, patience, and forbearance, to walk in a way worthy of our call. And from my wrestling days, there's this old adage that rings true. Our coaches would always tell us, where the head goes, the body follows. We had the express application for that saying of driving people's faces into a mat. But there's another and more, you know, a more beautiful application to this truth. See where Christ goes and how he goes. The head of the church. And how he decides to get there. That's where and how the body that holds fast to him will go. And again, I confess this fully, it would be so much easier to see the whole project unravel and fall apart than it is to heed God's call, to step into this reality and this work and to be given to it despite all its difficulty. But the thing here in the scriptures is that ease, that's not even a question. The question is worth. What's worth it to you, to us? It's quite clear the whole of Scripture over what was worth it to God. For family to happen as it should, family must happen within the church. And for this to happen, we need to be committed and given to a long, arduous, and yet worthwhile, loving walk with God and with one another. And so in conclusion, I want to make mention of another and a more ancient metaphor that involves knitting. The Greeks, they had a myth about knitting that served them as a metaphor for life. The myth of the three fates, the sisters Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos. I have more Greek lessons coming. If you think of the Disney movie back in the day, Hercules, you know, the little sister spinning the thread and snipping it, cackling away. That's what this myth is. And in this myth of the three fates, these sisters would spin the thread of human fate, they would dispense it, and finally, they'd cut it, signifying death. And metaphorically speaking, the message, it was common knowledge, right? There's a great and decisive snipping of a thread that hangs above all our heads. We're all just biding our time until our thread is cut, and whatever happens before then, it's not in our hands. So don't worry, because what good will that do? Well, thankfully, the Bible and its gospel tell us an inverse story. It's a story, true story, not just a little fable, that counters this kind of fatalism with faith. God takes that which is fallen, relationally, just this mess of humanity that's severed, detached, and separated from himself and one another, and he knits it back together. Estrangement from God, per the fall, it precedes the shining of the gospel. Therefore, estrangement actually comes before fellowship with God. And so, spiritual death precedes spiritual life. We talk of being born again. Just the same physical death, it's followed by resurrection, and for God's people, eternal life. There's this beautiful cadence that plays out throughout the Bible. And it's in this familiar vein that the fractured and bloodied affair of family is knit back together, healed, returned to its intended form as a body of peace, love, and worship. So much easier to unravel a piece of fabric than it is to weave something together, especially when you're handling severed, uncooperative threads. But this is what God does. He takes what is dead, what is hostile, what is hopeless, and he gives us life, peace, and hope. And he does this as no one else can. That's why we need to let God knit. And it's why we need to look to Christ, and we need to see what he has done on the cross. Again, per communion this morning, we need to remember. We need to behold the peace that Christ is, the peace that Christ makes, and the peace that Christ preaches. And through it all, we need to be humble. Humble with Christ as our reason, holding fast to him who's the head, because what sin, hostility, and death would rend asunder, that is what God enjoins and gives life. That's us. The scriptures have shown us that this singular body that God knits together, it's a mosaic of service and sacrifice. It demonstrates humility, gentleness, patience, and forbearance, an entity fitting of the designation family. And that's why God sent his son, in part, to make us so. And in part, that's why he sent Paul and others after him, to urge and to prod us towards his son. So this morning, will you come and will you follow? Will you be woven, even woven together with others like you, others like me, people who down to our core need grace and salvation? Will you strive to pursue and to maintain the bond, the unity, the peace, and the love that Christ died for? You know, if Christ has not reduced this dividing wall in each of our hearts to rubble, then it doesn't matter what side of it we think we're on. The truth will be that we will be the rabble, the ones who, despite all appearances of nearness, have hearts that truly are far off. And so I'd like to say, in line with the scriptures this morning, don't be far off. Love God, love neighbor, love even your enemies, and put into action in your own life these virtues that Christ has modeled for us and that the Spirit empowers us to live out. This is our call. So draw near to him, that Christ may cause you to see and also to be that which God knits together in love. Amen.